as a younger stage business, you're more likely to get funding for those type of assets where there's already a really well understood funding universe relative to where there's very little evidence.
My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models.
Welcome to the sixth episode of PaaS Decoded, 16 conversations about the fine details of product as a service. In the last episode, Leonard van Mentz gave the bank's perspective on funding product as a service. In today's episode, we take the perspective of an investor and look at assessing the circularity of a portfolio company and funding the assets. He studied technology and business studies and has a master's degree in economics from the University of Cambridge. He has worked in investment banking and private equity for nearly 20 years. In 2015, he co-founded Circularity Capital. Circularity Capital is invested in multiple product as a service companies: Bike Club, Grover, WeBike, Lendis, and Advanced Clothing Solutions. He's a member of Circularity Capital's investment committee and leads the firm's pan-European origination practice. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, Patrick. That's a really nice introduction, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Great. On a personal note, what's the subscription you personally like the most?
Well, I have two young children, so I'm a Bike Club subscriber. They grow very quickly, the children, like weeds. And so the transition through the different bike sizes is made really easy through the Bike Club.
Yeah, I can relate to that as a dad of two small kids as well. Let's switch to the circular capital perspective. Your investment approach includes circular use models. Are they in any way different than product as a service?
So, a really good question. So, here at Circularity Capital, we invest in businesses operating in or enabling the circular economy across Europe. We're typically investing between 20 and 40 million euros in growth stage companies right across the circular economy, from circular use models to circular products and materials and enabling solutions. But let's deep dive on the circular use. So when we think about circular use, we think about businesses that are using rental subscription models whereby they keep assets on their own balance sheets. So that's product as a service in our mind. And then secondly, within circular use, we think about businesses that are refurbishing, repairing, remanufacturing products for extended product life. And they don't need to be doing that for their own balance sheet. They could be doing that for others.
Okay, clear. So a bit also, let's say, supporting functions, supporting activities.
Exactly. Yeah.
If we stick to the product as a service model, when is a product as a service model for you a circular product as a service model?
So firstly, I should say that Circularity Capital invests in businesses that are impactful versus business as usual. So we would only look at a product as a service model as being impactful and circular if the traditional business as usual in that market is quite linear. So to give you an example and use the Bike Club as a starting point, today most people buy children's bikes and use them, possibly sell them on or gift them to other friends and family. And often they are downgraded in their next use case, where perhaps they're stuck in the garage or a shed for 4 years before anyone does anything with them.
I don't do that. I think we have three unused. We have three right now, or maybe four, to be honest.
So in our mind, business as usual is linear ownership. So the Bike Club provides a circular solution, which is impactful versus business as usual. And where it becomes circular in our minds is if they are designing their business model to have the cycle through multiple users, and in between times, in between users, the company is extending the upgrading the asset or extending the asset life. So in the bike example, it could be changing the handlebars, it could be repainting the frame, upgrading the brakes, essentially making it look as good as new or close to new between every use, and therefore maintaining that asset so it can extend its life and number of users that it can service. So if the business is designing its business model to keep assets in circulation for longer, and it's often designing the assets in that way also, then it becomes a very circular model in our mind.
Okay. So it's a bit a combination of qualitative criteria and quantitative. Qualitative foremost, like, is there intention? Is it part of the strategy and the business model design? And quantitative in a way that you try to benchmark with existing customer behavior.
Exactly. Exactly. So that the benchmarking with customer behavior demonstrates the impact versus business as usual. And the intentionality within the business model and the business demonstrates the commitment to the circular economy. So, for example, if we look at Grover, which is a B2C consumer electronics subscription model, very circular in our mind, in what is a very linear traditional market, Grover buys assets that it wants to cycle through many users over many years. And whilst Grover themselves don't do the refurbishment or the cleaning and upgrading between cycles, they are doing that through a third party, which is contracted by Grover intentionally to keep the product in as good as new for as long as it can. Mm-hmm. So the company doesn't need to do the activity itself in terms of the refurbishment, repair, cleaning, upgrading. But as long as it's implicit in the business model and it actually does it and it's economically rewarded for doing so, then we think it's a locked-in circular economy model.
Okay. Okay. The world outside is normally pretty messy. How do you determine whether this behavior the company triggers is actually superior to behavior customers would do otherwise? How do you collect that data? Do companies, or like say startups, when they start talking to you, you do your due diligence? Do most of the startups or scale ups already provide that data to you? Or how does that process look like so that you ultimately can make a decision about the degree of circularity?
Yeah, really good observation. And you're right, the world is messy and not every customer does the same thing. The point at which we are investing is typically in this kind of scale up or growth stage. So the companies that we're talking to already have quite a lot of granular data about how their customers use products and services. But we also have a theory of change in our minds before we make an investment, and we're testing that theory through diligence, market research, and customer engagement over the course of the diligence period to really test whether our theories are translated into actual reality within the chosen customer base.
Okay, so you actually collect data about the customer behavior. Just trying to reflect on my 5 years of experience at Blue Movement, what's normally interesting is that you want to track change of behavior over time. Yeah, so you also see, okay, right now I am reaching one specific segment, but I want to grow more towards another segment due to various reasons, be it like profitability or be it also impact, customer lifetime. Ideally, you probably want to make a diligence process with data you need to collect over a couple of months, but you don't want to have so long diligence process. Can you provide a bit of a, let's say, an example? If you look at the customer behavior of a specific company you're reviewing?
Sure. Well, let me use some examples from the portfolio companies. So you're right. You want to test your theories and the customer behavior over a long period of time, which is why we're also investing at when the company mm-hmm. has, you know, significant customer attraction and engagement. So it may be the case that the companies that we're investing in have, you know, 5 years worth plus of customer data since their founding. Yeah. So we can get quite a rich data set from their existing customer data to help us really evaluate our theory of change. And then we would do regular annual data analysis to support the mm-hmm. theory of change on an annual basis off post-investment. So we could see whether that theory was still standing the test of time over multiple years. And then we would adjust our calculations on the impact based on the actual customer behavior post-investment.
So, and in, let's say, in the case of a bicycle company, you probably also send out surveys and ask people about their actual behavior and what they would have done if they didn't sign up to this specific solution.
Yes, exactly. So using Bike Club as a good example, when we invested, they had 4, maybe 5 years worth of customer data. And many of those customers were continuing subscribers. So we could be in touch with the continuing subscriber base, conduct surveys as to why they were using the service, how many bikes they'd been through, what condition they mm-hmm. received them in, what condition they returned them in, what activity was done by Bike Club between customer uses on that specific bike. So we can track it at customer level and also on an asset level. And given mm-hmm. that the circular economy is about increasing asset utilization, it's really important to look at it on an asset level basis. So in the software systems of the company, one would expect to be able to see a asset go out to a customer, be returned after a set period of time, it be processed by the business to upgrade it, extend the life, maintain it, etc., before being sent out again to the next customer. And you should see that process happen 2 or 3 times, possibly more, in a 5-year period. And if you're not seeing that level of asset level activity to extend asset life, then that would be a major flag.
There is sometimes a discussion about rebound effects when it comes to product as a service models, because they make certain products more accessible from a financial point of view. Is there also a way that you can account for possible rebound effects in your assessment?
So in terms of how we measure the impact of our investments, we are absolutely taking into account potential rebound effects. And as I say, because we're investing, you know, 4 or 5 years after the business has been founded and there is customer data, we can get quite a good view on what that rebound effect is from the existing customer base and by extension, the forecast customer base.
Now, let's say, zooming out, you collected all the data, made the analysis, and you get an idea of the circularity of that specific business. What importance does this data have in comparison to commercial KPIs?
So if you think about our investment process, we are screening for circular economy alignment, then screening for impact, then screening for the commercial KPIs. And the reason that we focus on screening for circular economy first is because we truly believe that a well-organized, well-run circular economy business will be able to outcompete its linear peers. So that mm-hmm. already gives you a sense of confidence that the business will deliver some good commercial KPIs and maybe an attractive investment opportunity. And then you have to take it the next steps into the impact and then, of course, into the more traditional commercial assessment. But fundamentally, we start from the view that circular strategies will outcompete linear strategies. So when you start from that perspective, everything else can be additional.
Okay.
We don't believe circular strategies can win out in every asset class at all times. For instance, people tend not to subscribe for pencils. They would typically buy a pencil. So we have a view as to what types of asset work in a circular use model and a products and service model and which don't. And so we're applying that filter too.
Plus probably at the point in time you're sitting, there has been quite some selection already before. I mean, first you need to grow the business for 4 or 5 years to be qualified to, let's say, knock on your door, so to say. That's another filter, at least on the commercial side. Yeah.
Exactly.
And if at some point a pencil subscription will get to the point, I'm pretty sure you're curious to look at that.
Yeah, I'll certainly be curious. I mean, we're happy to be, to learn more all the time.
Great. Let's look a bit at one specific, let's say, challenge of product as a service models, and this is funding the assets. I talked to so many startups in the early phase, and this is the number one topic where they fail. Circularity Capital is a private equity company. The capital you provide, can that be used to finance the assets? Or is it only for the growth of the company? So what's your view on that?
So it's a really good topic to cover. Products and service businesses do require quite a heavy balance sheet of assets to allow for the use and subscriber numbers. And the funding of that is really crucial in our minds. Our capital is there to help the business grow. It can be used for funding the assets, but we don't think that equity funding assets is the optimal way of growing a business. Because as you rightly said at the start, typically the assets derive a longer term return. So you need to demonstrate an efficient capital structure for a product or service model. And that typically involves quite a lot of debt funding to purchase and maintain the asset base. And that's another reason why there are specific assets that are more suitable for products or service models than others. Back to my pencil analogy, banks typically won't fund a collection of pencils, but they will fund consumer electronics items. And we can go into kind of some of the reasons for that. And the sort of primary ones are that there is a already quite transparent secondary market for used consumer electronics. So lenders typically are looking to see what the asset value of the devices or assets are at any given time. And if they needed to, what could they sell them for to recover their loan? And so when you're doing that sort of analysis, you want to know that there's large market in which you can sell these devices, that the pricing within that market is relatively stable and transparent, and that you could get comfort that if you were to sell the asset pool that you funded in the secondary market, we'd be able to translate that into cash, which is what the lenders are seeking to do. So for a startup, scale-up, products or service business that is seeking to raise capital, they should be thinking quite hard about the efficient use of capital and how they might blend equity and debt into their capital structure. If they're considering the use of debt, then what are the metrics that the lenders would use to assess the business and the risk of the underlying loan?
Mm-hmm.
One of the risks or the metrics they would use is their ability to realize value in a wind up scenario. So this, being able to resell the assets, and of course another one of many KPIs that a lender would use would be the strength of the underlying customer. Often B2B subscription businesses are easier to deal with because the customers have stronger credit ratings, but you can get it in a consumer setting also if you can demonstrate that the underlying consumer has a good credit score, indeed, that you can recover the asset and resell it for a reliable value. So having a really good understanding of the depreciation curves of the assets is really important.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And thanks for elaborating on that field as a start. Do you see any superior, let's say, debt solution that most, if not all, the growth and scale-up companies use?
Currently, asset-based funding or subscription funding are the two most commonly structures that we've seen. I think in the end, and once you've got to scale, then there could be more of a securitized facility. And it's worth just touching on that a little bit. So the banks or the lenders typically want to lend, you know, quite large sums of money. So let's say like a minimum of £25 million, and, you know, could be up to, you know, £500 billion. So lots of assets of relatively low value. So back to my pencil analogy, there would be lots and lots of pencils required to get to a €25 million facility, which again is quite cumbersome for the lender. How do I get hold of all these pencils? Who's got them? Keep track of the subscriber, the logistics of gathering these pencils together really outweighs the cost of the logistics, the cost of the pencil or the value of the pencil. Therefore, it just doesn't make sense. But when you start to think about it like, well, you know, what if it's a vehicle, a car, you know, let's say €15,000 value, you have many fewer €15,000 packages to make up a €25 million facility. The logistics costs of getting them back are lower relative to the value. So it starts to make more economic sense. And of course, this can scale. There's a sweet spot between a pencil and a car that also works. So children's bikes, you know, let's say they're on average €400 asset value, iPhone or a tablet, you know, somewhere in the range of €400 to €1,000. That also makes sense for the types of financing and the ticket sizes of lenders. That sort of asset value makes sense.
Okay. At the beginning of your answer, you said you differentiated between asset-based financing and another one.
Yes, sir. Consumer subscription or subscription financing. So some lenders will look at the quality of the customer and the typical longevity of the customer and think about financing on the basis of the long-term stream of cash flows from the customer rather than necessarily the value of the asset and the depreciation curve of the asset. So if you've got really strong credit quality customers, whether B2B or B2C, and you can demonstrate that the average customer life is, let's say, 10 years, then a lender would take a lot of comfort from the stream of cash that comes from your customer rather than perhaps the underlying value of the asset. So two different approaches.
What I've seen at Grover from the outside, it looks like that they're not even banks. They're also normal, let's say, financial institutions that want to invest in that asset class.
Yes. So what we've witnessed in the market what has happened in the market is that there's been an explosion in non-bank lenders.
Okay.
Probably over the last 10 to 15 years. So whilst, you know, 10, 15 years ago, if you wanted to get a loan, you had to go to a bank. Now you can go to special credit funds or other sort of non-bank institutions who have a specialism in lending. The variety and the possibility of lenders has expanded significantly over the years, which is I think is a strength and is also a reflection on the way that banking market has moved with additional regulation all across the globe and these alternative lenders, credit funds, etc., have sprung up to provide this support that would otherwise have been provided in the past by traditional banks.
Okay. And do you see them also as a partner to bridge early phases of growth? Because what I've witnessed a lot is that startups start with a great product or service idea, and then they manage to get, let's say, 100 to 500 subscriptions based on the funding they got from friends and family, sometimes even small strategic investors. But then at some point, it gets more expensive. You need more cash, but it's not yet so substantial that the bank would already invest in. So do you see specific providers that help in that situation, especially in that phase?
That is a very difficult phase for products to service businesses. Back to my earlier comment in that lenders typically like to extend quite large sums of money in one go.
Yeah.
So they might have a minimum drawdown of 2, 3, 5 million for a 25 million euro facility. So the company needs to provide the working capital to get to that group of assets that or subscription cohort that allows for that drawdown from the lender. And then the lender needs to have the comfort that they continue, that the business can continue to generate that sort of flow of new customers to onboard that number of assets or that subscriber base to fill the full facility in the short term, let's say over a 2 to 3 year period. So that there is an extended equity bridging period required for products or service businesses, in my mind, before they can become sort of relatively working capital efficient and move on to a capital structure that's more efficient through the use of leverage.
Okay. What also happens is that then you collaborate with a strategic investor or some brands that reduce a bit the stress on your own balance sheet by different payment terms. So that's also something that happens.
Yes, another way of getting around that situation is to provide your product as a service in a market where there's already really common funding for that type of asset. So, give you an example, a JCB digger. There's very well-established markets for funding of that quality. The lenders have a really good sense of what the asset value is, what the depreciation curve is, and what the residual value is, and that there's a strong secondary market. That would be an example where you, as a younger stage business, you're more likely to get funding for those type of assets where there's already a really well understood funding universe relative to, my example of a pencil earlier where there's very little evidence. So clearly it depends on the business's chosen asset base. But if that asset base is already very well understood by the lender environment, then it's possible that you can get access to debt capacity earlier than you would in a more nascent asset category.
That makes sense. There's less insecurity on the lender side, given existing market, existing data.
Yeah, and having long-term contracts. In a B2B environment, if you have long-term contracts, subscription or rental contracts with your B2B customer, that would be another way of shortening the period to get financing, particularly if the B2B, the business customer, is of really high credit quality.
Yeah, true. Let's touch upon the last aspect, which is actually about the time horizon. I sometimes feel that a product as a service with long-lasting products, and let's say in my case, washing machines, that they come with a rather late break even of individual contracts. So if you want to compete with the buying proposition, the linear proposition, ideally, and if you want to address the mass market, you might want to put the break-even of the individual contract at, let's say, 5, 6, 7 years in the future, which can be a challenge from the provider side, because then, of course, in turn, the whole business model won't break even before that, most likely later, because you're growing the business, which also requires capital. So if you look at product as a service models, does the product lifetime matter for you? Is this a specific criteria you look at?
Yeah, so product lifetime is really important, because in the end, what you as a business, if you're trying to increase asset utilization and you know, displace multiple devices with one device, then the asset life is really important, whether that's, you know, kind of designed in, or your ability to refurbish, remanufacture, upgrade in a modular way, for example, is really important. But I think there's two things here. So yes, absolutely, a long-lived assets is important, but you have to pair that with short-lived customer use cases. So if you've got a long-lived item and a long-life customer use case, then the likelihood is that it's harder for the customer to make the case of buy versus rent or subscribe. And therefore, you have to kind of reduce the cost and extend the break even for the customer longer and longer. Whereas if you have long life assets and a relatively short customer use case, then you can build that return much earlier in the asset life. So if we take the children's bike subscription as an example, children's bikes are relatively simple pieces of technology. They don't evolve very much from year to year, but the child grows. So they typically only need a bike for 18 months before they grow out of it. So that's an example of where you've got a really long use case for the asset, but a short use case for the customer. And it's that relationship that works the best in these environments.
Awesome explanation. In the last years, never met someone who, let's say, nailed that relationship so sharply.
Thank you.
So that makes me even more curious to finish off with three more generic questions. The first one is, what do you think, what's the main thing you as a startup, a brand, or a manufacturer should make sure before you start a circular product as a service?
Now you're putting me on the spot for all these OEMs. So I would think really hard about quality of your product, how mm-hmm. long realistically the asset life is, and how you can maintain it for longer life. I would then look at the service proposition of your customers. How long are they going to actually use it for? And then I would look at the financeability of it. And I think, and maybe it's going slightly off topic, but I think that OEMs and brands that have traditionally been very high quality, long asset life, there is much more opportunity in the circular economy than there is for cheaper brands without this sort of high quality product that will typically last longer. And there isn't a sort of cachet of ownership or use. Kind of know your background, but if I translate it into white goods in the home, you know, I think Miele and others at that sort of level of price points, sort of brand awareness, cachet, quality, longevity of asset life, have more of an opportunity than the cheaper alternatives, where their likely life is shorter and the customer is, you know, kind of less excited about owning one or using one, I should say. And you know, you can equally translate that into, you know, clothing. You know, is it more likely that someone will subscribe to Chanel than it is for them to subscribe to Gap or Pound Stretcher?
That absolutely makes sense, and I think you're right that companies that have that strength in terms of longevity, customer service, and durability overall, that they have a better starting position. which doesn't necessarily mean that you can always make a product as a service work for every, let's say, niche or proposition, yeah, or target audience, especially considering what we discussed before about the use cases and how long a customer will need that specific product. Taking everything else as equal, the companies have a better positioning there, definitely. The second question looks more into the future. What significant trends do you see in circular renting in the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, I think it's going to grow in terms of consumer model. There'll be more and more willingness for consumers to shift to rental and subscription rather than ownership. And I think there's a number of sort of mega trends that are allowing for that. So I'm excited to see the consumer market grow within the existing assets that are already offering circular solutions. And I'm also really excited to see a wider adoption across different asset classes. I think fashion is coming. We've seen in the US, you know, a lot of excitement over the last 5-10 years on Rent the Runway, for instance, and lots of the secondhand trading platforms for used clothes and garments. I think that's going to increase as the next generation come through, you know, increase their earning power and have more influence on the market.
That's a motivating outlook.
Generally, we're seeing prices of goods increase and the utility of those goods increase. And, you know, if we think about, you know, when we first started using mobile phones, we used them only to make phone calls. Now they're you know, diaries, emails, tide timetables, weather forecasting devices, you know, all sorts. The utility of these items is increasing, and that requires more technology, more software, and increasing the cost of the device, and indeed the importance of it to individuals. And, you know, that is also helpful in a product to service model. The same with, you know, e-bikes, for example. I mean, the adoption of e-bikes over the last 5 years has really changed the e-bike market, or the bike market in general. You know, to buy a new e-bike, it's, you know, 3,000 plus euros. But 10 years ago, you could buy an adult's bike for 500. But what we're seeing is that actually e-bikes are extending the use case of bikes for longer distances. So people are more willing to use bikes for longer journeys. And they're enabling the use of bikes for extended age ranges, which is fantastic. Well, a number of health benefits.
Absolutely.
Also.
Yeah. I'm inclined to check Bike Club right now if they already have an e-bike for kids.
Well, so what I was saying is that the e-bikes are extending at the upper end. So we're seeing more elderly people cycling, which is great. We want the kids to be pedaling hard. Get rid of the energy that they have.
true. To make sure that they only need the e-bike towards the end of their life and not already earlier.
Exactly.
And cool, Andrew, thanks. That brings me to my last question. Circularity FM is about sharing knowledge and connecting people. And maybe you have certain topics you want to look into, milestones to reach, questions you discuss right now. So if someone is listening to this episode right now, who should get in touch with you?
Look, I'd be happy to talk with anyone who's trying to accelerate the circular economy. That's kind of our mission here at Circularity. We're doing that with a combination of knowledge and capital, which we apply to our portfolio companies and the management teams that we work with. But I'd be delighted to hear from anyone seeking to start or develop their circular economy journey. And they can get in touch with me on LinkedIn or drop me an email at andrew.shannon@circularitycapital.com.
Wonderful. That sounds like a big invitation. Thanks a lot, Andrew, for sharing your insights. And thanks again, especially for this perspective that is in particular helpful to early stage product as a service founders.
Not at all, Patrick. I really enjoyed it. And I hope it's useful to some of the listeners.
I'm pretty sure. Thanks.
Great.
This was another episode of PaaS Decoded, 16 conversations about the fine details of product as a service. If you liked it, share this episode with colleagues or on social media. If you missed a question or topic, please send me an email so I can improve the conversations for you. If you learned something from this episode, please provide a review via Spotify or Apple Podcasts. That helps others to discover the podcast. And don't forget, the most abundant renewable resource is your imagination.
My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models.